Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined by my co-host Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well.
Good to hear.
After that terse bit of small talk, we'd also delighted to welcome back to the show Jan McVarish from the Free Speech Union. How are you doing, Jan?
Hello. All right, thank you.
So, Jan, should we start with you and a big topic in the world of freedom of speech over the course of the past couple of weeks, which is the Labour Party's decision not to implement the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill. This was one of the, certainly from our perspective, a big legislative achievement of the last government. It wasn't perfect, but it did toughen up the requirements on universities for freedom of speech. It took the kind of existing legal duties, gave people forms of redress if they did find themselves silenced on campus. And very early on in this new Labour government, quite significantly, it seems, that was something that they just pushed away. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the bill and why Labour, you know, on what grounds Labour have trashed it?
Well, I suspect they've trashed it because they don't think there's a free speech problem on campus. I mean, I think it's the scepticism about that that I think must run through all of this. And it's very familiar. So over the last few years, you can see it, in certain settings, if you talk about academic freedom and the problem of free speech on campus, the audience completely gets it. And the people you're talking to have got numerous examples, they've experienced it for themselves. And then in other settings, if you say it, there's a kind of eye roll and a cynicism. And I think Labour's been in the environs of the eye rollers. And unfortunately, the eye rollers include many of the vice chancellors who run universities and the kind of levels of bureaucracy that are running the universities. It includes the academic unions, all of whom have welcomed this. It was going to be something that was going to be imposed on the sector. Mm-hmm. That was the point of that. That's why the legislation was necessary, was because the sector was resistant to actually shoring up free speech and showing any commitment to it, or even recognising that there was a problem. So it's hugely disappointing. I don't think we anticipated them doing this, and certainly not doing it so quickly. So they would have had to do it quickly. It's the only way they can do it, because it was due to be enacted on the 1st of August.
Mm-hmm. Just for the listeners, so as I understand it, what this bill would have done is that it would have allowed people to appeal to the Office for Students for the kind of free speech czar if they had found their freedom of speech curtailed. Also introduced this sort of statutory tort, so there would be some sort of legal redress if you had a speaker or a student group or whatever who found themselves on the wrong end of campus censorship. I think that would strike a lot of people as relatively straightforward, surely uncontroversial measures. Why is even something like this So causing such an eye roll and also leading Labour to feel like they're in a position to get rid of it?
Well, it was controversial, and it took an awful lot of to-ing and fro-ing to get it through both houses. And I mean, I think when I joined the Free Speech Union in 2020, it was already being talked about. I can't remember when the process of legislation started, but it's taken a really long time, and there was an awful lot of resistance. And it's been pared down. In addition to what you've said, is also there was a proactive obligation on universities to promote free speech amongst students. And in a way, that's what I was the most keen on, was because it would require them, or at least you could make the case that they had an obligation to sort of educate students as they came in the importance of academic freedom, so that students understood that this is what this place is for. Mm-hmm. And to put free speech and academic freedom at the heart of the university. What this has done is it sidelined it relative to other considerations and said, actually, the consideration of academic freedom is too burdensome relative to the safety and well-being of our students. And what they mean by that is that Bridget Phillipson explicitly invoked minority students as somehow suffering from unleashed free speech that she imagined would happen, which I think is so disingenuous and a very dangerous thing to do, where you pose the need to inhibit people's freedoms in the name of protecting minorities, which I think is, I don't think it's true. I don't think it will help. And also, I don't think it's minorities necessarily that are calling for it, although it has been, the decision by the government has been welcomed by some of the Jewish groups who've lobbied, you know, against freedom of speech for a long time, because they are very worried about anti-Semitism, which I completely understand. Mm-hmm. But there's a sort of red herring that's been raised about Holocaust denial somehow. Universities being obliged to protect and facilitate the platforming Holocaust deniers. I'm not sure any of them are left anymore.
Well, that's what I was going to say. How many Holocaust deniers?
Well, I don't think there's very many. I mean, I'm not even sure. The other day I thought that David Irving is dead, but I don't think he is actually. So I spread a bit of misinformation about that. But nevertheless, I don't think there's anybody else in that type of Holocaust denial. There's an awful lot of Holocaust minimising going on all over campuses and including in seminars and lectures. So but that clearly isn't the problem that the government's thinking about. So, yeah, I think it's the statutory talk was controversial. Some people were saying, oh, well, that's just, it's kind of technical and it's petty and it's litigious. But actually, if you look at some of the cases that have arisen over the last few years, and many of which have now gone the way of the academic or the student, particularly academics, they have proven that that academics have actively been discriminated against and unprotected by their institutions at employment tribunals. There's one yesterday, Laura Favaro, who is a researcher at City University of London. And she won an employment tribunal because the City University, first of all, failed to protect her from abuse and harassment when she started to publish preliminary findings from her research. Her research was into the suppression of debate around gender-critical ideas and the trans issue in academia. So she'd interviewed 50 academics, I think, to find out what had been going on, particularly in the women's studies kind of and gender studies sector. And when she published a preliminary article about it in, I think, the Times Higher, some of her interviewees turned on her and other people in the sector, came up with false complaints about her ethical practice, which is pretty devastating as an academic if that gets, if you're accused of that. And she was sacked. So it's just that kind of thing has been going on all the time. And even worse, actually, in her case, it's a real academic freedom issue. Her research data was withdrawn from her control. So she'd done all of this research and somehow City managed to lock it down under some rule or other and denied her access to it. So the work that she'd done over the previous years was no longer accessible. So she couldn't even prove that what she was doing was ethical, it was academically valid, and that she was making really important headway in understanding the issue. So that's that's just yesterday that judgment came through. So the idea that there's somehow not a problem, and that's before you get onto students banging tambourines and saucepans outside of gender-critical speakers at debate unions, etc., and that kind of thing. So, everybody knows about Kathleen Stock. There's so many other cases, and I can reel off a list. I was making a note of all of the ones that, people may not have heard of. Michael Biggs and John Armstrong, who are one at Oxford, one at in London at King's, who that's in the kind of field of academic publishing, who tried to publish articles questioning data collection around trans, the figures for trans individuals in UK. They found out through a subject access request that the editor of one of the journals they were submitting to had decided they shouldn't be published because of their views they'd expressed on Twitter about the issue, even though peer reviewers had greeted the article favourably. So there's just so much going on in the sector.
And so many of it swirling around gender critical issues as well, which does seem to have really brought, I thought for a while, the debate much more to the mainstream, because there was this unfortunate fact of the matter was that when it was people who were more on the right, when it was no platform for fascists was the slogan, it was a lot harder to kind of land the argument that there was a problem with freedom of speech on campus, that the culture was going awry. But you just had a lot of these largely kind of left-wing women who were making arguments that were entirely socially acceptable 5 minutes ago, suddenly found themselves in the crosshairs. And I did maybe hold out a bit of hope that this would be one of those quote-unquote culture war issues on which Labour would just leave it alone for the desire not to have too much of a fight, not to ruffle too many feathers. But do you think it does show, Jan, that this Labour government, whilst it doesn't seem to have many principles, it does seem to have this kind of authoritarian bent, or at least a refusal to admit that there is a problem with something like free speech on campus?
Yes, I think they see no value in freedom. I honestly think they don't understand why it's really important in any way for there to be academic freedom and for there to be an open exploration of difficult questions. I genuinely think they just don't understand. Don't understand it. Mm-hmm. Because those women, some of them would have been Labour supporters, and they've been trying to speak to the Labour Party for years about these things, and they're not, some of the gender critical organisations are not allowed to go to Labour Party conference an exhibit or even be part of it and have meetings. So within the Labour Party, the mainstream of the Labour Party, there just is an absolute lack of curiosity about what's been going on to women, such that there's just a deafness. Mm-hmm. And I think they see for some reason, they think their bread is buttered more by the trans side of things than it is by women raising very, very important issues about women's rights and safe spaces and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, in addition to that is just this culture among students of what was described to me today by an academic I was talking to as just increased timidity, which is coming in with each new cohort of students because they know they can't say things. And so to try to get them to actually explore and to discuss amongst themselves in a seminar, which ought to be a relatively safe space to do that, is just becoming increasingly difficult, which makes it impossible to actually educate.
And that's something you can't really legislate for, the culture. But as you say, it was just a bit of a shame because of this bill felt like a first step in a conversation in a way towards creating a bit more space. But Chris, big sort of question for you. Do you think that the universities are just kind of lost to this kind of thing now? Because this was a pretty minor form of pushback in some respects, or pretty modest legislatively, and that's fallen down.
I hope so. People shouldn't go to university. They should go to the library. University is a massive con for the vast majority of people who go to it, and any intelligent person should avoid it. And people who are not intelligent shouldn't be going there in the first place, but they should be told by people who are more intelligent to avoid it because they're going to get themselves in a lot of debt and probably won't get a job at the end of it. So anything in a way that undermines the university is good, as far as I'm concerned. And it puts intelligent people off from going is good. But on this, specifically with regards, I'm interested why Labour decided to actually overturn it, because it's very easy when you get into government to leave things alone.
Yeah.
Certainly that's what the bloody Tories did, try and repeal anything that Labour had done. And you've got to question why they felt this was a priority, because I don't think it was a very salient issue for the general public. I think insofar as the public were aware of it, they probably were in favour of it. And so it does show it shows their intent, doesn't it? I think the Labour Party, 4 weeks ago, we were sat here talking about how we're all going to be in the gulag under Starmer. And so far, Peter Hitchens has not been proven correct on this particular issue. And who knows what's going to happen. But Labour so far, I've been quite hopeful about it. Been trying to give credit where credit's due. Done a few sort of decent-ish things, or at least, house building, I suppose. One or two other things that escaped my mind right now. But I think we're in for a tough few years, but we always are, aren't we?
And Janet, surely there's also, this is a kind of expression of intent to a certain extent on the part of the Labour Party. They almost didn't have to do this, the fact that they did. There's also been things which have been floated by Keir Starmer and other leading Labourites over the years, toughening up hate crime around gender, which basically seems to be along the lines of making it tantamount to hate speech to misgender people and so on. There's a big appetite within this Labour Party for press regulation. People like Keir Starmer, Ed Miliband have traditionally been really in favour of it. At the Free Speech Union, is there that concern that this is going to be the start of one of many kind of encroachments upon freedom of speech in this parliament?
Well, I think it certainly sets the tone, doesn't it? I mean, and the way in which it was argued for, besides the argument that it would take away the rights or freedoms of minority students who are vulnerable, was the idea that the priority needs to be at the moment with kind of financial survival of the university sector, which is true. There's a huge crisis and numerous universities look like they may well fail and fall, which will be terrible for students that are there and halfway through courses. Yeah. And it's terrible for staff, some of whom are my colleagues, former colleagues. So that's all, it is pretty disastrous in the sector. But it's that idea of, it's almost like a survivalist mindset. We're so kind of rational and grown up. Free speech, that's something for another day, rather than that being the absolute underpinning.
The reason they're there.
Democracy. the reason for a university, the underpinning of democracy. And then, in fact, the way in which this sort of rowback was done, it wasn't announced in Parliament. It was a kind of ministerial statement that was issued. There is just no appreciation, I don't think, of things that really, really matter to a society and to cohesion, to understanding itself, to being able to discuss really important issues. That's all very worrying, which I think, you know, we're also worried about, you know, hate speech legislation like the one in Scotland potentially creeping into English legislation.
It's been such a roaring success up there, uncontroversial piece of law.
Well, it's one of those things where, even though actually I don't think we haven't had reports of a huge influx of arrests or anything like that, but it sets a culture or confirms a culture which people already thought in a way was in place. If this idea of, well, you can't say that. Mm-hmm. And even if it never reaches the law, it has this huge chilling effect on society where you only need a few prosecutions. You don't need everybody to be locked up. You only need a few to symbolically indicate to everybody else that we're on a new terrain now and you actually can't say these things. Mm-hmm. And in a way, people already think that, but it would absolutely confirm it to people. So, yeah, we're going to Belfast in September for another event. We did a really successful one earlier in the year when there's kind of hate crime legislation there that's brewing, which obviously in that context is, you know, everywhere that it's enacted, it means something very different. But in Belfast, Northern Ireland, it would be incredibly oppressive for huge, really, really important political issues to be discussed. Mm-hmm.
It'll be very annoying if this trans stuff flares up again, because I thought we'd seen the back of it. Do you know what I thought? There seemed to be this consensus to let, you know, Starmer seemed to kind of admit that certainly, you know, 99.99% of of people with penises are men, and it seemed to be sorting out the prison situation, the sport situation, and now it sounds like it's coming back. Generally, it felt like the culture had kind of found a reasonable common sense equilibrium. We could stop talking about this bloody boring issue. It's going to flare up again. We have to listen to people going on about it.
It's a reminder that they are culture warriors as well. Because of course, this Labour government came in. You had Lisa and Andy announcing that the culture wars were over.
Yeah.
There was no need for them to reopen the trans question if they didn't feel that they needed to. You know, the cast review was already kind of being implemented and recognised. They didn't need to start again floating ideas about easing up gender recognition processes. They could have left this free speech bill where it was because, you know, in the grand scheme of things, is it really going to, who is it going to upset by getting rid of it? Yeah, they obviously do care about it.
Exactly. This shows that they actually do care. No one really knows what Starmer cares about.
Yeah.
But this is a sign that these are the kind of, unfortunately,
not being allowed to misgender people is right up there for some bizarre reason.
I think the natural constituency for them are people who do actually believe this stuff and are genuinely believe in the huge confusion that somehow men are women and women are men, and the idea then that children should be totally kind of free-forming themselves into whatever human being they want to be. Mm-hmm. I think that goes very, very deep. I don't think it is something that can just be reversed or was anywhere near that. I mean,
But it is loony left stuff, though. Let's call it what it is. You know, the people go, Starmer, he's a right winger, he's a centrist, whatever. This, you know, the trans issue is a prime example of what used to be called the loony left. And it's just become sort of normalized now to some extent.
And it's got this kind of preeminence in the culture. And specifically, as you say, John, amongst the people who are kind of the base of the Labour Party now. And it's even if Starmer, you know, in his heart of hearts doesn't really believe in this or hasn't really thought about it. It becomes like the kind of state religion. Like, even if you don't really believe in it yourself, you have to at least go to church on Sunday occasionally and indicate to the public that you're on their side.
Because it looks like it's got a mission to it. Mm. It looks like it's got some kind of energy and appeal to it, weirdly. And it may not have that to us, but I think to other people, it looks like it's moving somewhere. And it's kind of changing things for the better. So I do think they instinctively move towards those kinds of things. And then they move away from, even when after they've paid lip service to women's equality, women's rights and safety. I just think it is so fragile, any kind of movement in the direction that we might want it to go in, that it's just this huge undertow that can always pull it back. And it's there, it's not just in government, it's there in every single institution. So there's this huge battle.
The other thing is, though, it's free. It doesn't cost any money. And, you know, like something like the lifting the two-child benefit cap, that's the kind of thing you would think the Labour Party would kind of backtrack on and do that, right? But that does cost money. And it's like we said on this podcast before, that one of the dangers with Labour getting in with the public finances in the state that they are is that they will just, because they'll be unable to turn on the spending taps, they will go for cultural war issues and nanny state issues and the stuff that, you know, it shows that they're doing something, but it doesn't actually cost them any money.
Exactly. Things that have costs on individual society, people's pockets, but just not the state coffers and whatnot. But on that slightly pessimistic note, let's move on and talk about some of the stories that you've picked out, Chris, in our kind of junk science section of the podcast, really, where you pick out and talk about some of the ludicrous claims from the nanny state.
From the nanny state.
Shall we start off with some statistics on alcohol?
Alcohol, yeah. Yeah, there's been a lot of junk science returned since the election. I think coincidence since the election. But yeah, I love talking about these things. We had a couple last episode. Regular listeners will fondly recall. So this time it's the old question of does moderate drinking have any health benefits in addition to the numerous social and psychological benefits? There are a relatively small number of neo-temperance academics who are desperate to cast doubt on the very well-proven benefits of moderate drinking, which, put simply, come from reducing cardiovascular disease risk mostly. And because heart disease is such a big killer, that has a big effect on overall mortality. And so drinking a moderate amount, and the debate really is what a moderate amount is, mm-hmm. It's been shown to reduce heart disease risk in particular, and we kind of know why that is. It affects various biomarkers in the body, being shown in animal experiments and all sorts of things. It shouldn't be it shouldn't really be a debating point at all, but it is, because there are people who want to treat alcohol like tobacco, and they therefore...
No safe level,
exactly, right? So around the world, governments are moving the guidelines down. We saw this in Britain when it went down to 14 units. At the behest of these people, right? And there's a very small group of people, mostly from Canada, who are constantly chipping away and producing new meta studies saying, we've looked at the data again, and actually we think there's no safe level. And the newspapers lap this up every time. So Tim Stockwell is a guy in Canada who's like most associated with this sort of counter-revolution. And the newspapers were full of his latest meta study last week. It actually got published in January. So why they press released it in July is a bit puzzling.
I think it's getting enough attention or something.
I don't think they press released it at all in January. I think the reason is that the USA has currently got a committee looking at this issue, and they close their consultation this week. I suspect it was to try and get a bit of media attention around that. Now, this study, I mean, this guy has been accused of cherry picking before, not least by me, but... A meta study is when you collect all the evidence together, right? And you, for want of a better word, average it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can use a quality analysis as well and say some studies are better than others, fine. And you can weight studies in different ways. But you're basically looking at the totality of the evidence to try and work out, in this instance, like what's the sweet spot for drinking. And it's not zero units, right? So he started off with well over 3,000 studies. And whittled them down to about 200. Now, there's reasons for doing that. Some of the studies were, some of them might be in the grey literature, some of them might just be letters to the editor and stuff like that. But there are, well, a shadow of a doubt, hundreds and hundreds of studies looking at this. He then got that down to about 200 cohort studies, which a cohort study is where you theoretically kind of track people over time. And so you ask them what they're drinking in 1990 and you see what they die of in 2010, for example. He then whittled down over 200 cohort studies to six based on some pretty arbitrary criteria, at which point the benefits of moderate drinking had disappeared because he just picked the studies really that didn't show a lot. And then he got rid of one more, so he whittled it down to five, and that then showed a slight increase in risk at any level, i.e. there is no safe level and any amount of drinking is dangerous. Now, this is just very, very obviously cherry-picking. And I can't see any justification for his selection of studies at all. And of course, the totality of the evidence does show a big benefit from drinking a bit. I'm drinking quite a lot, in fact. Let's face it, something like three or four drinks a day. It seems to be, no more risky than drinking nothing at all. This stuff has no scientific merit, no academic merit. It's just there to get headlines. It's just that it confuses the public and clog up the search engines as well. Also, if you Google the benefits of moderate drinking, you just find loads of this guy's studies saying there aren't any. So it's propaganda. It's not real science. They'll keep doing it. The WHO has been saying for ages there's no safe level of alcohol. Upper normies often like to say, actually, people think there's benefits drinking, but there isn't. And no. Mm. But just quickly, it doesn't matter to me whether there are benefits from moderate drinking. Firstly, I don't drink moderately. I drink excessively. And secondly, I don't drink for the health benefits. I drink because I enjoy drinking for lots of different reasons. So it doesn't make any difference to drinkers whether there's a reduction in heart disease risk or not. It's just the fact that it matters so much to these people makes me suspicious about their motives, right? What are they? Why are they so desperate to make it look like any amount of drinking is bad? I'll tell you, it's because tobacconization of alcohol. They want to treat it like tobacco. And if you're a drinker, just think about how smokers are treated in the modern world. Do you want to be like that? Probably not. Mm. So it might seem like a fairly trivial issue, but it's all part of a plan.
Mm-hmm. And what do you make of this, Jan? This kind of very miserable attempt to suggest that there's no benefits from alcohol whatsoever. We're better off just dispensing with it.
It just seems to get us into this situation, which we seem to be in lots of different ways, which is people still do exactly what they were doing before, but they do it while feeling guilty about it and apologising. So at the moment, the number of conversations I've had with people, very middle-class people, who say, well, obviously we've planned our summer holiday and obviously we should be getting the train. However, we can't get to Southeast Asia that way. And it's just, it's so really nauseating about that kind of apologia while still doing exactly the thing you want to do. And I shouldn't really be drinking. I'm not a big fan of drunkenness, not least because I can't bear hangovers. Although maybe that's probably not true, actually. I am a big fan of drunkenness when I'm doing it. and by the point where I've forgotten that that's the situation. But I do think that there's this idea of sort of a zero tolerance approach. And I saw it when we were doing research previously, before I joined the FSU, on drinking in pregnancy, where there was this sort of really concerted attempt to have a zero level, zero tolerance of any drinking alcohol in pregnancy, which seems sort of common sense to a lot of people, because I think the rise in women's drinking levels over the 20th century has been quite, a social phenomenon. It's an interesting thing. And I presume in the past there weren't that many women that were pregnant, or maybe fewer women that were pregnant were drinking quite a lot while doing it.
They were smoking instead.
Well, exactly, yes. But certainly sort of the culture of women drinking has changed a lot, hasn't it, in the 20th century and the 21st. Yeah, but that's women being liberated for you. That's what it looks like. So... But then that idea of women having to stop suddenly when they become pregnant, and kind of quite a big shift in behaviour, which might not have been required in my mother's generation, where they weren't really drinking in the first place. But then, of course, the argument becomes about health, on really frightening health claims about risk to the baby.
Which is mostly bollocks as well.
Well, I know.
Fetal alcohol syndrome is a real thing that's been weaponised by these people. You need to drink a lot to put your baby at any risk of that. And because we don't know exactly what a safe level is, because how would you even run an experiment to work it out, these people just go, well, there's no safe level. It's not true. Just because we don't know exactly what the safe level is doesn't mean that women should be petrified of having a half a shandy once a week or something.
Yeah, so there's some really, and there's been some really good studies on this, actually, about where this has come from as a set of claims. Sort of claims from America of families who'd adopted children who turned out to have developmental problems.
From Russia, very often.
Well, maybe it was some of the ones I knew of were not that, but it was basically children with a sort of nebulous set of developmental problems. And then that got labeled as fetal alcohol syndrome. And then it was traced back to the birth mother, and the adoptive parents hadn't been told about it. So these kinds of things end up a very unusual problem of fetal alcohol syndrome, as Chris said, but then becomes something that everybody's spotting. So I remember somebody saying to me about, they'd seen some, misbehaving youth in inner city London, and said, I'm pretty sure they had fetal alcohol syndrome. I think, what exactly have you got on this?
I don't think you can diagnose it that easily.
It was the distance between their eyes or something, And so, but of course, you start to see it everywhere. And women, women who have drunk during pregnancy, then start to see their babies in a very anxious kind of way, especially if there is a problem. I mean, that's the most horrendous situation, is women who have had moderate to whatever level of drinking. And then if the child does then develop some kind of issues as they're growing, to then try to blame yourself for that is obviously really horrendous.
And piles on that level of guilt, but on sort of steroids if it's someone who's carrying a baby at that particular point. It, I mean, is part of this just bred of the sort of implicit contempt that a lot of public health messaging has, which is that ordinary people can't really deal with nuance. That if you say to them, well, the studies roughly say this, you could probably do this, that'd be fine, whatever. I mean, it was something we certainly saw during the pandemic where they thought really simplistic, drastic messages is infinitely better than saying to people, here are the risks, make your own decisions. Is that part of it, Chris? Is it just saying we need something to be as simplistic as possible? Yeah. Or is it full-blown, we're rolling the pitch for...
It was both. It's both. I mean, even when it was very widely accepted amongst doctors that there were benefits from moderate drinking, which is not so common now because of this kind of campaign against it, doctors still were told, don't tell someone who doesn't drink to start drinking moderately. Because they might not, they might become alcoholics. And it's like, well, no, you should, if let's say the benefits of moderate drinking are comparable with exercising or statins, right, which they are. I mean, we're talking about a, 20-30% reduction in risk of cardiovascular disease, a very common disease. That would be comparable with regular exercise and statins. Doctors, based on that evidence, would absolutely recommend you exercise, and they absolutely would prescribe you statins. They would never say to somebody who's a teetotaler, you should maybe think about having the odd brandy, maybe one brandy a night, something like that, which maybe they would have done in the 30s or something like that, because they don't trust people not to go too far, or they don't want to send out the wrong message, is what they would say. Oh, it's all about sending a message, and the message has got to be that alcohol is toxic. Mm-hmm. And bad.
But I think that's the kind of where it happens in the health domain. But I think there's also something really even more disturbing about it in a way, which is this idea that you could somehow roll back or undo something that is so fundamental to European culture. Mm. I mean, making wine and beer and brandies and champagne and consuming them seasonally and all the kind of culture of appreciation and production is absolutely, it's so fundamental to European culture. I mean, I guess in other places in the world, but I don't know about that. Other places, obviously, presume they don't drink. But, to European culture, drinking is really, really important. And there was that great film, Norwegian film, Another Round. Mm. I don't know whether you saw this. You'd love it, Chris. It's about a bunch of school teachers in Norway coming from a town where there is this culture of drinking. And so young students, when they graduate every year from school, they have this sort of ritual where they have to run as a team around a lake while carrying a barrel of beer, which they have to consume as they run.
Sounds awful.
But what the film is about is that these men try to find the optimal level of daily alcohol consumption to achieve the sweet spot where you just feel great, but then you don't have any of the next stage of, of drunkenness.
Three points.
But they look into it scientifically. So they each experiment with this. They do it as a group, but they each have different kind of outcomes. But it's what it makes you really appreciate is just how important alcohol is to Western culture in all different kinds of ways. And yes, there's the kind of bit where it all goes a bit tits up. But then short of that is everybody else, the integration of it into life and to rites of passage. Mm-hmm. And, every momentous event has got alcohol as part of it, and it's so important. And then from the kind of high culture level, we saw this in the wonderful Parisian Olympics opening ceremony, the celebration of food and wine.
and many drag queens.
I've just been reading a book called Drunk by, I think it's called Edward Slingerland. I highly recommend it. It's I think the guy's a philosopher. It's just about how not just booze, but actually getting drunk is the basis of civilization. I mean, not even exaggerating. Like, where would we be without it? He says it's so important in so many ways. And he does actually mention the moderate drinking thing. And he says it's just irrelevant. It doesn't matter because it's not about that. But there are so many benefits to it from, in a modern age, having a drink after work and spitballing with your colleagues, coming up with ideas for creative people. Similar, like microdosing, I guess they're using in California, but having a beer is just as good. It's a very, very good book. It makes you feel that drinking is a kind of civic duty, actually, after you drink that. Read that.
That's a message I can endorse. Also, we've got both film and book recommendations on this
podcast now. So this is
There we go. I'll check. What's it called? Another round.
And drunk.
Yes.
People should check out. Chris, we're fast running out of time, but just in a nutshell, do you want to talk about this gambling story that you've raised? I know it's a topic that you've talked a lot about, which is the kind of inflation of the problem gambling.
Massive inflation.
Problem. But do you want to tell us this new study?
Yeah. So this has been coming for a while. The Gambling Commission is using a new survey to try and work out how many people are problem gamblers. Problem gamblers, firstly, are not gambling addicts, or that's what the media often call them. They're people who show symptoms of having, at least had in some point, a problem gambling. So it's things like chasing losses, spending more money than you expected to, and so on. And the surveys that have been published in Britain for the last 25 years have always found the figure to be around about 0.5%, so one in 200 people. The Gambling Commission is now using a new survey, which finds a prevalence figure of about 2.5%, so five times higher. And this, of course, is next to the anti-gambling lobby, who have always been a bit disappointed that problem gambling is such a rare thing, really. And it's, I think, very interesting to see how this survey has come up with this this much, much higher figure, which is now going to be the official statistic. It's because, and the Gambling Commission knew this beforehand, because they commissioned an academic to look at it, and he said this is going to almost certainly overstate the problem. They use an internet survey. So you're randomly selected to get an email saying, would you like to take a survey about gambling? In fact, you get a letter, I think, actually, through the door. And if you don't respond, you get another letter saying, if you don't want to do the online survey, you can do it by post. And if you still don't respond, they just leave you alone. And it gets a very, very low number of people taking it up, 19%, which is really a tiny figure, right? So it's no longer a random sample. Mm-hmm. It's at that point, it becomes self-selecting because less than one in five people are choosing to do the thing. So what kind of people do you think are going to say yes to this? People who are interested in gambling, obviously. And in fact, people who are very interested in gambling are most likely to do it. And people who are problem gamblers are very interested in gambling.
Yeah.
So it's immediately like red rag to a bull. You're going to attract more gamblers and you're going to attract more problem gamblers. And so no wonder you get a higher problem gambling prevalence from it. Now, the study that we used to use was very different. It was the health survey for England. You would get randomly selected again, saying, would you like to take part in a health survey for England? And people at that point would think, well, it's kind of my civic duty to take part in these things. So the take-up rate for that was about 50%. So it was way more representative. Plus, it didn't have gambling in the title. It was just the health survey. And then halfway through the survey, you get a few questions about gambling. So it was a genuinely pretty random and representative sample that reflects the population at large. This new one doesn't. All it tells you is what the problem gambling rate is amongst people who choose to do a survey about gambling. It's completely useless. The authorities and the Gambling Commission knew this, and they just don't care. I think the Gambling Commission is quite happy to think that there's a much bigger problem than there really is. And the kicker to this is the Gambling Commission is so aware that this is faulty data that a few days before they published this thing, they sent out this press release telling people and the media, basically telling the media how to report it. And it says you can use these figures with caution to say this percent of the population is problem gamblers, but you can't gross that up, by which they mean you can't work out how many people that is.
Oh, I see.
So you can say 2.5% of the population may be problem gamblers, the maybe being a caution, but you can't say 1.3 million people are problem gamblers, even though that amounts to exactly the same thing. I actually got an email from the Gambling Commission. I wrote about this last week. And a couple of days later, the Gambling Commission got in touch saying, we're very keen that our statistics are used in the proper way. We found two problems with this article. One of them was me just saying, the survey says that 1% of gamblers had sought help for their gambling. And I said, well, that would be 680,000 people. And yet only 9,000 people approached GamCare last year. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't really work out. Even if you add in a few, people are going to Gamblers Anonymous and a couple of helplines, you get nowhere near 680,000 people.
So this is them almost admitting tacitly that their numbers are terrible and don't reflect the...
Basically, yeah. So you're allowed to say 1% of gamblers have sought help according to this survey, but you're not allowed to say 680,000. And it's like, well, I mean, I just said to the critic, just ignore them. They're making it up as they go along. It's kind of, somebody gave me the analogy of it's kind of like when Post Office Tower was officially a national secret and he couldn't be put on the Ordnance Survey map, even though everybody could see it and you go in and visit it. It's like you can, it's such, I mean, fortunately, none of this guidance has any legal bearing whatsoever. You know, they've got no authority to tell people what to write. So they can just, you know, send out these stupid emails. But it's just weird that they are going like, oh, you can say this, but you can't say basically the same thing. So I think you could say that there are 53 million adults in Britain, and according to this survey, 2.5% of them are problem gamblers. But you can't say, according to this survey, there are 1.3 million. People have to work it out for themselves. It's bizarre.
Doesn't make any sense. But Jan, I don't know if you've got a burning point to make on gambling, but we are almost out of time and I want to go straight to the postbag.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
We've got a question here about your work in the FSU. How does the FSU defend people who've been cancelled, and what kind of cases do you see most often? So like, what's the process like, I suppose, if someone kind of approaches the organisation, says, are they members already? Do they become members? How does that work?
Well, both actually. So quite often people join us at the point at which they experience cancel culture or some kind of free speech issue. So although we've got 14,000 members, most of those won't become cases. Otherwise we'd be rather overstretched.
Yeah.
But they quite often people join us. They've not necessarily heard of us before, but somebody else has said when they've heard about their predicament, do you know, you should contact the Free Speech Union. And what we'll tend to do is indicate that we can offer some initial advice, but they should join us and then we will be able to properly help them. And it can be anything. So some people just want some advice because they've got a training module being proposed at work on DEI or whatever, identity issues, that kind of thing, or climate. And they know that they suspect they may not agree with everything in that training module. And they want to know how they can reasonably object or be part of it, but raise questions in a reasonable way. So they might come to us and we're really good at advising at that kind of level. Or it might be that they have already raised a question in a training module and then they need some help because they're being threatened with disciplinary processes. And that might be that we talk people through how to get themselves out of the problem, or we go one step further and write a letter to their employer emphasising the rights of the employee, and then all the way up to, you know, through to employment tribunals. And then even, I think, cases of appeal in the High Court and maybe even judicial reviews. It's kind of, and then obviously our work in the legislative side of things of legislation like the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act. Mm-hmm. In terms of casework, we've had, I think, over 2,300 cases since we started four years ago. And that can be anything from the sort of initial inquiry from somebody to all the way through to supporting somebody like Laura Favaro, who we were involved in her case, putting them in touch with lawyers who are sympathetic, who will do a really great job of defending them. And we've had some really good wins. So to bring it back round to the alcohol issue, I remembered one of our cases that we won was a chap called Jeremy Sleeth, who was a train driver, who during lockdown... When, in fact, the pubs reopened at the end of lockdown or some point in lockdown, I can't remember, it's all a blur. He tweeted or put on Facebook something along the lines of, thank God for that, the pubs are open, who wants to live in a Muslim caliphate? And for that, he lost his job. Mm. So we successfully won his case on his behalf. So something like that. I don't know how he joined. I mean, my colleagues might know, but whether he was already a member or not, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it really varies. It really varies.
And what everyone should... get involved, or even just, and to become a member, even just to support the work that you
well,
do.
Well, I think out of the 14,000, the majority of them will be people who just want us to exist and be able to kind of grow and support more people. So it's kind of altruistic on their part, but also they want us to be able to make the arguments out there in the world as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Chris, we've got a few questions for you here, but I'm going to limit it to one so we can save some for next time.
Mm-hmm.
How long, this is from Disaster R Inc. on X, full Christian name, I'm sure. How long until we get at least a partial ban on alcohol consumption via dry towns or increasing the age of consumption to e.g. 21 or 25? So it kind of links in what you were saying earlier about how the direction of travel where alcohol is concerned is really not dissimilar from where we're going with tobacco.
If the public health people get their way, I mean, they're facing a lot of resistance in practice, right? Of all the things that public health people are trying to clamp down on, alcohol is probably having an easier time than, certainly obviously than tobacco, probably more so than vapes, and definitely more so than gambling and indeed ultra-processed foods. So, you know, politicians like drinking, broadly speaking, the public like drinking. The Tories were more likely to cut the tax on alcohol than to raise it. So I think in Britain, we're probably going to be okay, but things can soon change. You know, I wouldn't have expected Rishi Sunak to suddenly say he was going to ban tobacco until it happened. It will be a while. It will be a while, and we'll be in a pretty dire strait in all sorts of other ways by the time it happens. I'm not complacent about it, but it's, you know, these people are playing a very long game.
Yeah,
they're playing a long game at the WHO. They're playing a long game in the scientific literature, trying to get a consensus that alcohol is comparable with tobacco. You know, they will get there. They're going in the right direction. It's not like they're getting any real pushback. But I think other things will be banned before that happens.
On that semi-positive note, Chris, Jan, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank
you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.